Understanding. We can discuss our needs further at our meeting a week from Monday when I arrive. Sincerely, Sean Safford, Vice President, Marketing, Bike House Custom Motorcycles. It was after 1 a.m. when Brock arrived home. Dave was perched on his entrance steps.
It's about time.
Dave? What are you doing here?
You dropped by my house late at night. I'm returning the favor.
I'm just glad you showed. I was getting nervous that you were at a sleepover.
Are you okay? Brock asked.
Do you have a second to talk?
Sure. Let's go inside.
Dave didn't wait. Listen, I need to know about this. He held out the envelope he'd retrieved from Brock's office. Brock took the letter, squinted.
You've been going through my mail? Have you been drinking?
Just water. Why wasn't I told about this account? Brock plopped down on the step next to Dave.
You haven't exactly been around much lately.
He let his words hang.
Where were you today, for example?
Point taken.
Why do you care about this account anyway? Brock asked.
At the very moment I crossed the bridge, I'd have experienced the best that life had to offer. I'd have lived my dream. I'd have arrived.
I'm just interested. Do you think Ellen will let me work on it?
Brock shook his head.
We don't even have the account yet. And when we do, it'll only need one lead.
Dave, you've been so distant.
The truth is, you'd be lucky if she let you blink on your own right now. And rightly so.
Dave knew Brock was right, but he didn't care. If I can convince Ellen, will you let me take the account?
Brock laughed, then moved closer. Buddy, I'm swamped. I'd love to give it up. But honestly, I don't think you're ready.
Dave fidgeted. How could he convince him? How much should he tell him? Brock spoke before he could decide.
I recognize that look.
What look? Dave asked.
Your mind going a million miles an hour, working through a problem? Tracing out every possible path? I have to say, that's a look I haven't seen in quite a while.
I need this account, Brock.
The only difference is that tonight you also seem a bit giddy, or desperate. Are you taking anything?
What?
You know, drugs.
No, of course not.
Let me smell your breath, Brock said.
It was Dave's turn to laugh. Brock leaned back.
I haven't heard you laugh like that in weeks.
Dave shrugged it off. This was working. Brock, I'm telling you, I can handle it. I can. Brock offered a pat on the shoulder, the kind a father might give a son.
Look, the meeting with Bike House isn't scheduled until a week from Monday. Clean yourself up, get a haircut, then talk to Ellen. What's the worst she can say?
Then it's okay with you?
Brock nodded. I'm warning you, though. There's no way you'll convince her. But if you want to give it a shot, I'll back you.
In the deep recesses of his brain, Dave began to plan his strategy. As he did, it invited questions. Why was he so intrigued? Did this client come along as a coincidence, or was there something more happening here? The possibility had crossed his mind that he might be losing it mentally, that he could be drifting over the edge. There was no reason to be so excited, so hopeful over one silly account, other than the fact that every time he thought about Bike House, Megan's words echoed in his head. One problem existed. His boss still stood in the way. Chapter 12. Desperate men take desperate measures, or so the saying goes. Dave didn't feel desperate, simply reaching, hoping to grasp something that would pull him away from the edge of the cliff. Anything that would help him make sense out of the recent events in his life. He leaned against the glass of the fourth-story office window and scanned the street. Ellen always arrived early, so it was no surprise at 6:15 to see her green Mercedes approach the building and wait for the gate to lift open. Dave knew it was a habit that drove her husband crazy, as the man would often voice his loud disdain at company gatherings, especially after he'd sipped a few too many drinks.
"You're the boss," he'd insist to his wife. "You don't need to get there early."
Ellen had confided in Dave on several occasions that her being the boss was exactly the reason she did. Dave hurried to his own office and waited for the elevator to ring its arrival on the floor. Once it did, he gave Ellen 10 more minutes to settle in before he tapped on the door.
"Dave?"
Her surprise appeared genuine. "Good morning." Ellen stood, shook Dave's hand, and then motioned for him to sit. For the meeting, Dave had chosen his best suit, a black Armani and jacquard tie, both draped effortlessly. He wished he'd had time to get the jacket professionally pressed, but he'd had to settle for an early morning ironing at home. Despite the rush, he wore the clothes well, with power and confidence. Other than his longer-than-average hair, Dave looked normal.
"Why so early?" she asked.
Dave had planned his words carefully. There was no bluffing on this one. From the outset, he decided to get straight to the point.
"Brock told me about Bike House."
Dave left out the details of filtering through Brock's mail. Ellen nodded, waiting for him to finish.
"Brock is swamped with..."
Not what he'd wanted to say. The truth was that Brock was swamped with the work that Dave should have been doing.
"I'd like to help out by taking the account."
Dave sat tall in his chair and tried to look confident, as if it were his first interview at the firm.
"The Bike House account."
Ellen leaned closer.
"Your plate is already full, Dave. How's your own workload coming?"
Dave understood the real question.
"I'm doing better as of late. Much better."
She didn't seem to buy it.
"Dave, where were you 3 days last week? Yesterday, even?"
Just like her, not to miss a thing. What would sway her?
"I'm here today."
Her head bobbed in agreement.
"I still think you ought to get your current accounts under control, and then we can get you going on other things."
Dave stood. He couldn't get emotional. It may bring sympathy, but not the account. He turned, then took a deep breath.
"Ellen, listen to me. I've been to hell and back."
He paused.
"Actually, I guess the jury is still out on whether I'm really back. It's been rough, and I'm sorry for the way that I've acted."
"Dave, I'm not asking for an apology."
"I know, but I owe you one. I do. I've let you down. I've let Brock down. I've let the entire company down. And then there's myself."
"I have to ask, what's the big deal with Bike House?" How to answer? What should he tell her? The truth?
"Ellen, it's a personal thing."
"Personal?
What do you mean?"
"What dreams have you been missing out on, honey?"
"What dreams?"
"Megan. Well, Megan would tease me about riding a Harley. We'd joke about it. I always told her that I'd like to ride one someday." If Ellen had been attempting to contain her flow of confusion, the dam had now burst. Dave tensed. He didn't mean it to sound so ungrounded, so sentimental.
"Dave, I appreciate your enthusiasm, and I have to tell you that I haven't seen you this excited about an account for, well, for months."
Dave waited.
"But my answer is still no. Not yet."
Possibility shot through Dave's head. He could threaten to quit. Would she risk losing him? Probably. Did Dave care? Not about the job. Not lately. But that was before Bike House had rolled into the picture. What to do? He'd already expressed his interest. Perhaps he should just back off and wait.
"You're right."
Ellen tipped her head back, seeming surprised by the retreat. Dave walked toward the door. He touched the handle.
"Listen, Dave," Ellen said.
Dave stopped, turned, waited. She opened her desk and fumbled through some cards.
I've been waiting for the right time to give this to you. I've been asking around, and I'd like you to go and visit this person. Dr. Devin Jaspers. He comes highly recommended.
She stood, stepped forward, and held out the card. Dave took it politely and then stared at the name.
A shrink? Of sorts. He's a grief counselor. He helps people who have experienced, you know, a loss.
Dave listened.
You go see Devin. The firm will pick up the tab.
Keep improving, and you just may get the account.
Thank you, Ellen. I hope that it'll do you some good. And then you can do me some good.
Always a boss. When's the first meeting with Bikehouse? Dave asked.
We have our introduction a week from Monday.
She paused thoughtfully.
Tell you what, why don't you plan to be there? We'll play it by ear. If you've seen Dr. Jaspers, if things go well at the meeting, if you show me that the old Dave Riley is indeed back, then Bikehouse will be yours.
Dave shook her hand, gripping it tightly. He still had a shot.
The old Dave Riley will be there, I promise.
He walked confidently to his office. Gloria was not yet in. He took off his jacket and hung it on a wall hook just inside. He closed the office door. He still had a chance, still had hope. After he checked the lock, he sank into his chair, rested his head on the desk, and with a silk handkerchief pressed tightly against his mouth to muffle the sound, he quietly began to sob.
I don't pretend to be fast in my research, but I am thorough. It's the reason the professor hired me. The trait was ingrained in me at an early age, another lesson from my father. Katie, if you're going to do a job, do it right. I don't find his exact words in the journal, but I see notes from Patrick that foreshadow my father's expression. We're spinning cable on the bridge faster than it's ever been spun in the history of bridge building. Many times faster. 'Tis a tense and contradictory job. If we don't finish the cable by July, Roebling says the firm will lose money. Yet speed must be balanced by quality. As Strauss says, it's a bridge to last forever. I can't disagree. And so, for the balance between speed and quality, I let my own scale tip toward the latter. We must do the job right. It is a lesson that brims with my father's wisdom, and it makes me wonder, who was this man, and why did my father have his journal?
The receptionist flashed Dave the customary smile as she pushed the clipboard in his direction.
Please fill in the pertinent information, she said.
He carried the forms to a seat in the waiting room that greeted him with bright walls, customary magazines, and vases of fresh flowers. With the exception of an older woman asleep in a chair, it was almost homey. Within minutes, the same receptionist stepped out and announced, Mr. Riley, the doctor will see you now. Please come with me. He followed her down the hall and into the doctor's office. Vibrant artwork lined two of the office walls. He realized it was all meant to cheer up depressed clients.
Mr. Riley, the doctor held out her hand. I'm Devin Jaspers. It's a pleasure to meet you.
He shook the woman's hand, trying to hide his confusion. The receptionist placed the clipboard on the doctor's desk and scurried out.
You look perplexed.
I'm sorry. Dave let go of her hand and stepped back. I just thought, well, I thought Devin Jaspers was a man. Her nod was one of understanding.
Yes, I get that a lot. It's my mother's fault, and I'll never forgive her.
She motioned to the chair opposite her desk, and they both sat. He watched intently as she scanned his information. She reminded him of a patron studying a restaurant menu, not sure what to order. He had to handle this properly, assure the outcome. The fact that she was a woman could complicate things. Or would it help? He studied her as she flipped the pages. Perhaps early 40s? Though difficult to judge with her hair pulled back. Organized desk? Almost too organized. She sat back as she read, slightly relaxed, evident she was in no rush. "Would you like me to call you Mr. Riley or David?" she finally asked. As long as he could remember, everyone had called him Dave. "David will be fine." She scribbled it into her notes. "Thank you. I appreciate that. And call me Devin or Dr. Jaspers, whichever you prefer."
"Thank you, Doctor."
"Why don't we start with a little background? Tell me about yourself."
"Aren't I supposed to lie on a couch or something?"
"A couch? I'm sorry, all I have is the chair. Is it not comfortable?"
"Quite comfortable, I just thought..." He shrugged off the thought. "What would you like to know?"
"How long were you married?"
It was a simple question with a simple answer, but in a curious way it struck him to the core. She'd asked it in the past tense, as if to imply that the marriage was over.
"I have been married for 18 years. "How old were your children?"
She'd done it again.
How could she be so cold?
He looked up without answering, his hesitation obvious.
"Are you uncomfortable talking about the accident?" she asked.
"Shouldn't I be?"
"I want to start by saying that I'm very sorry."
"Yeah, so am I."
"David, you've had a loss that most people can't even imagine. My job is to help you get through the grieving process in the most manageable way possible. It won't be easy. It never is. But if you'll try, you will get through this."
He shifted in his chair as she continued.
"Have you talked much about the accident with family or friends?"
Megan had been his confidant. They had discussed everything. Now she was gone. Who could have replaced her? Dr. Jaspers tipped her head to the side, as if anticipating Dave's response before he had even moved his lips.
"So you don't have family? No support at all?"
"I'm an only child."
"Friends?"
"I have associates. Brock is my friend."
"Have you talked with Brock about the accident? About your grief?"
"Briefly. He's never lost anyone. In fact, he's never been with anyone long enough. Well, he would never understand."
"You should give him a chance. It will help if you talk with others about your loss. Share your feelings."
This was their first meeting. What did she know about his friends or his feelings? He had lost his wife and family, and she had the nerve to sit across from him in a padded chair and suggest that all he needed to do was talk. He studied her face more carefully. Younger than 40. 35, perhaps? How much experience could she have?
"I'm just curious. Are you married?" he asked coldly.
He wanted to control the flow of the meeting, manipulate its outcome. He could feel his emotions taking charge.
"No, I'm not."
"Divorced?"
"No, I've never been married."
"I should hook you up with Brock," his tone mocked.
"David, I'm here to help you. I'd like to be your friend."
"Friend?" The word irritated. He'd barely met the woman. They certainly weren't friends.
"Can I be brutally honest?" Dave asked.
"If you don't mind."
"I see grief as something I need to deal with on my own, not pawn off on friends, or worse, strangers. If you want the honest truth, Doctor, I'm here so that Ellen, my boss, will give me an account at work. An account I need to move forward with my life. Grief is my responsibility, not yours, not my friend's, mine."
After the words had spilled out, he was angry at himself for having betrayed his motives. He'd wanted to remain in control, and he'd blown it.
"Forced into it?"
"No gun, but essentially, yes.
I take it that your work is suffering. What do you think?
She ignored the question.
In what ways, exactly?
He wished that he could stand up and walk out, even slam the door on his exit. But his boss would certainly find out. Instead, he took a deep breath and closed his eyes.
Tired. I feel tired.
I drive around late at night. I oversleep, show up late. I find my thoughts constantly wandering. I can't concentrate. I watch people bickering at the office about petty things that don't matter, and it makes me want to scream.
Grieving can be exhausting.
She made a note on her pad, then put down her pen.
I can help you get through what you're feeling right now, David. I can't take it away or make it disappear. But if you'll work with me, I can soften, perhaps even shorten, your grieving process. I need your help, if you'll let me.
1 minute she was so clinical, so cold. Now instantly sincere.
Sincere.
He pondered the word. It was her job to be sincere. It was her job to pretend. She waited to speak again until he looked directly at her.
You said earlier that your friend Brock has never truly loved someone, and so he doesn't know what it means to experience true loss. Then you asked if I'd ever been married. I understand your meaning, what you were implying. You need to know, David, that I do know what it feels like to lose someone.
Her directness caught him off guard, and he regretted his harshness. She continued,
I can never know exactly what you are feeling. No one can. And in that aspect, you are indeed standing all alone. But don't you dare think for a moment that I don't care or that I can't empathize.
I didn't mean it to come out that way. After a long, almost painful moment, she spoke words that seemed to carry extra sadness.
David, I'd like you to take as much time as you need, but tell me all about Megan. Why you loved her. Why you miss her. Then, when you're finished, I'll tell you a little about Jonathan. And my loss as well.
Chapter 13. I should be working on the society's report, but instead spend hours studying the journal. Before bed, I continue to read Patrick O'Reilly's words. I'm working with a team of lads, hard and calloused men, on the Marin Tower. Today a fierce storm far out at sea caused tremendous swells to roll into the bay, swells that caused the tower to pitch and sway. As the tower shifted, I grabbed a beam for support, then glanced at me men to see if I'd been betrayed by me terror as a coward. 'Twas odd, but I noticed the fear of death in their eyes as well. Later in the pub, I asked Bull Myers about it, the most hardened of men. He grunted and said, "A man without fear is a fool." He is right. Men who deny fear, they take chances, do stupid things to prove valor. I no longer try to mask me fear. I see no shame to admit that the bridge scares the life from me. But what is even more frightful is the thought of not holding Anna and the young ones in me arms again. And so as it grows heavenward, and I climb the tower day by day, me fear grows into courage and keeps me safe. Courageous men are not fearless men, but those who climb despite fear. Everyone has a bridge to climb. At the end of the day, fear and I shake hands and part, knowing we'll meet again when we climb our bridge together. As I read Patrick's words, I imagine the panic my own father must have felt working on the bridge. And yet, I don't remember ever seeing his fear. Oh, he'd tell me that work was forbidding, even terrifying, but I didn't notice it in his eyes. Only in mine. Since my father's death, I have avoided towers, preferring to stay huddled on the ground. I wonder about uncertainties, my own swells and storms, Will I ever be as courageous as Patrick O'Reilly, or as brave as my own father? Well, the lesson is significant. It is Patrick's affection I find most stirring. Below his wisdom, in the margins of the page, Patrick often wrote thoughts of Anna. They're always apart from the engineering calculations, as if he didn't want their significance to be lost or confused. I don't pretend to understand their meaning, but two phrases cause reflection. They are haunting expressions, but words that carry strength. With this crown, I give my loyalty. With these hands, I promise to serve.
Ellen was reviewing financial charts on her computer when Dave tapped lightly on the door. Dave, come in. Listen, I spoke with Abel at the governor's office. They said your conclusions on voter trends were right on the money. They've calculated and projected 6% increase in turnout next election cycle, with limited resource outlays. They're talking about expanding the study. That's great, Dave tried to sound excited. You're not thrilled? She asked. Of course I am. It's fabulous. Listen, I've been seeing Dr. Jaspers. Already? 3 times since we talked, counting this morning. Well, that's great. So he's competent? Of course. Our meetings are going well. I'm scheduled twice a week now for the next 8 weeks. I just thought you should know. Ellen nodded her approval. Thanks, Dave. And have him bill the firm directly if insurance doesn't cover it. Dave paused at the door. You've never met the doctor, have you? No. A friend gave me the card and said he was terrific. Why do you ask? The he is actually a she. He's a woman? As his boss shrugged with surprise, Dave reiterated the message he had come to deliver. She's helping me. I'm doing much better. I just wanted you to know. When Dave arrived back at his desk, he stopped just long enough to gather up some papers and his jacket. Gloria, I'll be out the rest of the day. Dave hoped that his suit and tie wouldn't make him stand out like a tourist. As he approached the building, he regretted not having taken the time to go home first and change. He knew, however, that if he was going to convince Ellen to let him handle the bike house account, he'd need to learn everything he could about the company. Long ago, he'd discovered that the most useful information about an organization always came from the people in the trenches, those working directly with the customer on the front line. The front line was exactly where he was headed. He expected to find a run-down shop with a greasy mechanic or two milling about working on their hogs, something out of an Easy Rider movie. Instead, the showroom at the Lakeshore bike house location was breathtaking. It was more reminiscent of Las Vegas than of any biker movie scene. Rows of gleaming customized motorcycles stood in perfect symmetry, each basking in its own halogen spotlight. There were dozens of bikes, various makes and models, all immaculate and begging admiration. It wasn't a motorcycle shop. It was an art gallery. Michelangelo would have been in awe. But there was more. Behind the bikes was a store within a store, an area brimming with black leather jackets, shirts, pullovers, sweaters, gloves, socks, and every other imaginable fashion accessory, all branded with popular motorcycle logos. Not only dazzling, it was bustling. Dave slid quietly around the machines, hoping to not attract attention. His plan was to blend into the background and study the place before asking his questions. Hi, can I help you? The voice startled him. He'd been so involved in taking in the scene that he hadn't noticed the salesperson approaching from behind. Thanks, but right now I'm just looking. They're okay to touch. I beg your pardon? The bikes. They're okay to touch. I mean, look at them. Have you ever seen anything more beautiful? Dave scanned the room. The guy had a point. The polished machines were waving for attention. I need to be honest with you. Dave leaned over to read the salesman's tag. The name's Red. Pleasure to meet you.
He held out his hand, and Dave shook it. Red was a large, older man, with a round face that matched fat fingers. But he shook hands with authority, or at least enthusiasm. He smiled behind a gray handlebar mustache, turned up just enough on the ends to make him look like a circus ringmaster.
Red, I'm Dave Riley. It's nice to meet you, but actually I'm not here to buy a bike. I'm here to do some market research. I don't want to waste your time.
Dave expected a look of disappointment or puzzlement. As near as he could tell, Red showed neither.
No waste of my time. I normally work in the shop or at the parts counter. I come out to the sales floor when the regular sales guys are busy.
As if Dave's comments were just now registering, Red paused.
Market research? What does that mean?
Though his company technically hadn't landed the account, Dave decided that for the sake of easy explanation, he would pretend they had.
I work for Strategy Data. We're a marketing research and opinion firm. We've been hired by Bikehouse Corporate. And, well, I'm here to learn more about the product. Corporate sent you?
Not exactly. I picked the closest location and came in on my own. Red seemed intrigued.
What do they want to research?
The question was a fair one that Dave couldn't answer. He would be truthful. I don't know yet. We haven't gone that far.
Well, if they want to know about the bikes or the people who buy them, they can call me. I'll tell them what they need to know for a tenth of what they're paying you. No offense.
None taken.
So you've ridden a road bike for a while?
As long as I can remember. Do you mind if I ask you some questions?
Not at all. I'm paid by the hour.
When he flashed Dave a smile, a silver tooth glistened. Dave began with a list of questions he'd been forming in his head on the way over. Tell me about your customers. What type of person buys a customized motorcycle? Red took the question seriously, carefully considering his explanation.
When you look at a person, you can't tell so much who's a long-time rider and who's not.
What do you mean?
Well, take you, for example. I'd venture to say you've seldom been on a bike. Customized or otherwise.
Am I that obvious?
Well, look at you. You're scared to death.
Red swung his leg over the machine next to where they were standing and grabbed the handlebars. He looked more comfortable on the bike than off.
Now take a look at the guy there in the suit.
Red gestured to an older gentleman Dave had noticed earlier.
What would you guess about him?
Dave shrugged. He looks to me like a businessman killing time on his lunch hour. Red half nodded.
He's a businessman, all right, but don't let the suit fool you. That's Mason Weller. He's ridden in a club for years. He comes in time to time just to check out the new inventory. Not all riders sport tattoos and leather, you know.
Fair enough, Dave conceded.
Why do you ride?
Now that's a different question altogether. Red swung off the bike and motioned for Dave to follow him. They walked past the browsing customers and through a door marked Employees Only. In the back of the open warehouse, next to a partially opened garage door, sat a maroon and silver machine, polished like it was parade day.
That's my baby.
Red talked like a proud father.
It's an 83 FXSB Wide Glide. Shovelhead engine. Girling rear disc brake. Twin discs up front.
The words could have been Greek. Dave shrugged, half pretending to understand. However, it was Red's next instruction that startled him.
Get on.
What?
You asked why I ride. I'm gonna show you.
Dave stepped back. How about you just tell me? The remark caused Red to laugh aloud. It was a jolly laugh. And had his clothes been red with a white beard attached, Dave could have imagined Red working the mall in December.
Look, I just hate to get grease on my pants, Dave added, attempting to save face.
Without uttering a word, Red snatched a white rag from the adjacent counter. He spread it over his thick fingers and wiped down one side of the shiny bike. Without looking at it, he held it up for Dave to see that there wasn't so much as a smudge.
Red tossed the rag back onto the counter and turned back to Dave.
Look, I'm not asking you to ride it. I just want you to feel the power of the engine.
In a fluid motion, Red swept his leg over the bike, turned the key, and pressed the start button. The engine rumbled to life. Dave raised his voice to make sure Red could hear over the machine.
So you don't have to kickstart it. Electric start!
Red stepped off, then motioned for Dave to swing on to the echoing bike. Dave climbed on, then settled down into the leather seat. It was more comfortable than he'd expected. He grabbed the handlebars and pulled the weight off the stand. As he did, Red kicked the stand up into place against the frame.
How does she feel?
Good. He couldn't deny it. The power that sat beneath him, at his command, was exhilarating, even intimidating.
So, is the clutch in the handle?
Dave posed the question more to make conversation than to suggest any intent to actually ride the machine. Red nodded.
You want to inch it forward, just to get the feel?
I'm all right, really.
Come on, inch it forward!
It was either peer pressure or salesmanship at its finest. Dave hated to look foolish, so he nodded in the affirmative. Red explained how to pull in the clutch and drop the bike into first gear.
Just let it out slowly. Let it roll forward a few feet, and then pull her back and apply the brake. It's simple.
When Dave eased off the clutch, he released the handle too quickly. The bike lurched forward, and Red had to grab the machine to keep it from falling. Dave's cheeks flushed. He looked to Red, expecting to see concern. Instead, only excitement stared back. Red had a new pupil.
Did you feel that power? And this bike's nothing compared to a customized Dynawide glide. That one will really get your legs excited, if you know what I mean.
Red reached over, switched the key to off, and dropped down the kickstand. He was almost bouncing. Dave stepped off, happy to not embarrass himself further.
So you're saying it's the power of the bike that attracts people? Dave asked, picking up the conversation where they'd left off in the showroom.
Red's tone hushed.
Oh, these machines certainly have power, Dave. No question about it. But to answer honestly, no.
Okay, then, what? Red glanced around the garage, as if he were about to reveal the wisdom of ages.
It's the freedom, Dave.
He answered in a tone so reverently whispered, he could have been in church.
Freedom? Sure.
What do you mean?
We'll go riding together sometime and I'll show you.
Can't you just explain it?
It's kind of hard to explain, really.
Give it a try.
Well, it would go something like this.
Red leaned against his bike.
When you head out into this great country on your bike, and you watch the stripes of the pavement fly past, and you get to suck in the fresh air and marvel at the expanse of the sky, and feel the warmth of the earth, and realize there are forces bigger than you, well, it gives you a chance to clear your head, to find a place that's peaceful, that's meaningful. That's what I mean by freedom. Isn't that what everyone is looking for?
Dave's intuition had been right. If you want to know about a company or a product, go to the people on the front line.
You're not a mechanic, Dave stated emphatically.
Red seemed confused, not sure what to make of the remark.
I'm not?
No, not at all, Dave added.
You're the best damn salesman I've ever met.
Chapter 14. Patrick O'Reilly was more than an engineer. He was an artist. His drawings are stunning. Beside each one, I find meticulous calculations. Most I do not pretend to understand. Instead, what I find intriguing is the personality of the man that shines through his work. His anecdotal wisdom is everywhere, sometimes hidden in a phrase, other times highlighted in notes that span pages. With each discovery, my questions about him grow. I calculated the cable's dead load stress under normal temperatures, then presumed fully loaded side spans, and recomputed the live load stress for the hottest of days. I was astonished. Stress is less with a live load than with no load at all. The cable is more stressed when the bridge is empty than when it is crowded with autos. I presumed a mistake, but checked me figures, and the calculations remain. I was bothered for several days, until Mr. Moiseff explained that the stiffening truss should be a limbering truss, and that, in our bridge, the truss literally shirks the load, handing it over to the cables. It is marvelous indeed. With Anna and the wee ones distant, I too carry a greater load when empty. At times, my emptiness seems unbearable. I miss Anna so, and wish I had the means to reunite sooner. At times, she's but a distant memory, and I imagine she is not real at all, but the desperate vision of a wanting man. During those times, I stare at her picture, remember her smile, and know that each day I spend working on the bridge is a day closer to our reunion, a day closer to the time our family will be together. Must go now. I've been assigned to an evening crew, but I go with a smile. I go to work on the bridge for Anna. Another note is written in the margin. With this heart, I give you mine. I sense these expressions hold a deeper meaning. When all three are strung together, they sound almost like a wedding vow. Could it be so simple? Below the last phrase is a final plea, a mystery that confuses me further. I pray, Anna, that your crown be left and out. That is my heart's deepest desire. I'm curious by nature, and while I do find the words comforting, I also find myself wondering, crown? Left and out? What in the world could this possibly mean? Professor Winston calls our meetings employee evaluations. Our conversations, however, feel more like father-daughter talks. He said that he's been thrilled with my attitude as of late, though I hadn't realized I was any different. He accused me of secretly dating, and when I told him I hadn't, he promised he'd arrange something for me. I almost slapped him on the spot. Let me explain why. 4 months ago, I asked the professor to recommend an accountant. With a gleam in his eye, he set me up with his own accountant, a man who'd recently been divorced. When I say set me up, I don't mean for a tax consultation. At first I refused, but the professor often gets his way. He's a man who loves to get in the last word. As it turned out, his accountant was a good 10 years older than me and certainly not my type. Neither for dating, nor for accounting. To be polite, I forged ahead with the evening. He took me first to a movie and then to dinner, both nice enough. But afterward we drove to his apartment, where I was under the impression we would meet the professor and his wife for drinks. It turned out the professor wasn't coming, and I was alone with Napoleon Dynamite. He was nervous and trying way too hard, which in turn made me uneasy. He put on some soft mood music, poured each of us a drink, then pointed me toward the couch to sit and talk. He began by relating the details of his divorce, but then clued in from my manner that he was making a huge mistake. He fumbled for a bit. Then, as a last resort, he reverted to a subject he knew well. Tax law changes in the middle class. When I couldn't endure another moment, I excused myself and headed to the bathroom. Looking back, I'll admit that I was nervous, and thus irrational. But while in the bathroom, I noticed his toilet was running. When I say running, I mean that the float inside the tank that shuts off the water desperately needed an adjustment. Even after I'd flushed and waited, it still sounded like a river flowing down into the drain. And in a city where water conservation is pounded into the head of every child from birth, it grated on my nerves. I returned to the couch where my date hadn't missed a beat, but all I could hear was the toilet in the background. I couldn't decide which was worse, water torture or tax law. I can't pin down the exact moment when I snapped, but I believe it was between depreciating assets for maximum tax benefit and increasing the effective yield on after-tax earnings. I raised my hand, as if in school, and when he paused, I asked for a screwdriver. In my defense, I was raised by an iron worker, a man who spent his days maintaining the bridge, and he'd taught me well. Leaky toilets were my specialty. I'm sure my date was shocked at my request, but he obliged and then followed me into the bathroom, where I removed the lid on the toilet tank and adjusted the float. When I looked up, he mumbled something about the kitchen sink, and when I followed him there, sure enough, his faucet was dripping. I asked for a crescent wrench. He gave me pliers. I made do, and 15 minutes later that drip was also fixed. My hands were now greasy, and I don't know if it was shock or intimidation, but as he watched, he was unable to form any words, totally stumped as to where to pick up the conversation. His romantic background music now stood out like hip-hop at a bar mitzvah, so he hurried into the living room to shut it off. I followed and extended my hand in preparation for my polite departure. He shook it, and then checked his own to see if the grease had rubbed off. I turned, expecting him to open the door for me, but he stood frozen, with his eyes locked on my hands. I shrugged, opened the door myself, and escaped into the sanity of the hall. As I walked toward the street to grab a cab, I wasn't sure whether to laugh or scream, until I realized the reason for his stare. I was still holding his rusty pliers. I chose to laugh. The next day, as I protested to the professor while describing the evening's events, he chuckled so hard he snorted. I threatened him with bodily harm if he ever set me up again, but I must not have been convincing. He's been trying ever since. As a reminder to just say no, I still have those rusty pliers. Before I left the professor's office, he said something that I can't get out of my head. Next weekend, the Golden Gate Commemorative Society will hold a banquet that I'll need to attend. I dread the thought. The finicky old society ladies remind me of fancy house cats, but since they're paying for the study, I understand. That's not what has me curious and nervous. As I stood to leave, the smiling professor added, "Don't be late. I will have a surprise for you that evening, Katie. Trust me when I tell you it's something you'll remember for the rest of your life. Just in case, I'm going to take my pliers."
Chapter 15. "David, good morning." Dr. Jaspers reached out and shook Dave's hand.
"Good morning to you," Dave replied as he settled in. He hated the small talk. She seemed to enjoy it. Today, he stepped around it. "So, what do we talk about?"
"Let's start with the things that frustrate you." The doctor's question was a fair one.
"I go crazy when people say to my face that I'm still young, that I'll get married again. Like age matters. Like some other woman could replace Megan. Like the act of being married was the thing that was most important, not the person." She nodded her agreement.
"What else?"
"I hate it when people tell me that they know how I feel. No one knows how I feel. They don't understand the moments that I shared with Megan and the children. They haven't a clue what my family meant to me. They simply can't. They shouldn't say they know what I'm going through. They don't."
Although Dave often felt the doctor was controlling, and he still despised being forced into the sessions, he couldn't deny that their conversations were helpful. Even soothing. He continued, "I suppose you're going to tell me to cut them some slack, that the people who say those things are only trying to help.
Aren't they?
I guess so.
It's just confusing. How do you control yourself when you're feeling two opposite emotions? Disdain and gratitude, both at the same time.
Don't be too hard on yourself, David. Or on others. It's a painful process, so try to be patient.
Her answer was indirect. Not really an answer at all.
Perhaps there was no answer.
David, during our last visit, you said that you were going to clean out some of Megan's personal things from the house. Have you done that yet?
No. I've been busy at work.
I want to prepare you for the experience. When you do find the time, it can be difficult.
She stood and adjusted the thermostat, then added,
You said that work has been busy. I'm glad to see you're getting involved again. I am concerned, however, that you're using it to hide your feelings, to smooth them over rather than face them.
He leaned forward in his chair.
I'm facing them, little by little.
His words were paced and steady.
David, if you feel that working hard will assist in easing the pain, then I don't see a problem with it. I'm just saying that you need to be careful that you don't let it get in the way of healing.
That sounds just like something my mother would have said.
His tone mocked, but she accepted the comparison. The alarm on his watch sounded. He used it to limit the length of their conversations, an excuse to get back to the office.
The fact that you are able to reason through these feelings, David, that you are able to talk about them now, I think you're making progress.
He nodded his satisfaction, stood, and shook her hand. He thanked her again for her help and insight. On his way out, but before the door had closed, he confirmed what both already knew. See you on Friday. The game had been fabulous, with the Mets behind by one in the bottom of the ninth, and a runner on second base. Their third baseman nailed a line drive to the shortstop. The ball bounced off his glove, and the runner on second rounded third to head for home. It was close, but the umpire yelled safe, and the game was tied. At a 2-2 count, the next batter connected solidly, hammering the ball toward right field. It seemed to hang in the air, as if hesitating, but perhaps encouraged by the roaring crowd, dropped just out of reach over the fence for one of the most memorable walk-off home runs Mets fans had ever witnessed. It was nearly 11 before Brock's car stopped in front of Dave's house in Jamesburg.
What a game! Brock announced for the umpteenth time.
Dave agreed, the mood celebratory.
I'm gonna run in and see if they show highlights on the news. I still can't believe Westman's play at the plate.
The evening had been refreshing. No sentimentality, no discussions about pain or loss or anger. Just an evening of hot dogs, beer, and baseball.
What's your plan for tomorrow? Brock asked. Do you want to pick up some women?
Dave laughed.
Thanks, but I'll pass. Believe it or not, I made a haircut appointment for tomorrow morning. And on my own, I might add. After that, I've got some yard work to do.
A haircut? Way to go. But don't strain yourself mowing. Your big meeting's on Monday.
9 a.m. in the conference room.
See you then.
The friends slapped hands, then Dave stepped out and closed the car door. The night was gorgeous. He stood in the street and watched Brock drive away. And as the purr of the engine faded into the darkness, Dave wondered if there could be a more exhilarating sound than all the world. He grabbed the mail out of the box and wandered toward the house. The neighborhood was quiet, and he considered sitting on the porch for a bit to drag out the moment, until he checked the time. Just after 11. News would run for another 10 minutes, then he could catch the sports recap. He pushed his key into the lock, opened the door, and switched on the inside entry light. A flash startled him as the fixture's last bulb blew. He'd been meaning to replace the two that were already burned out.
Nothing like darkness to force a guy into action, he mumbled.
He felt his way into the kitchen, clicked on the light, and opened the pantry door.
Where were the extra bulbs?
Not there. He stepped to the island and pulled open the junk drawer. Every home had one, a place for odd tools and one-of-a-kind parts that fit nothing, until after they were thrown away. He rifled through the junk, but no bulbs. He glanced at his watch. He still had time to check the hall closet where Megan kept the cleaning solutions. Nothing. Thinking maybe she kept the bulbs up high where the kids wouldn't break them, he pulled aside a black plastic bag that took up most of the top shelf. If he didn't hurry, he would miss the replay of Westman's slide. And then an unexpected smell caught his attention. He pulled out the bag and tore it open. It had been such a good day, a needed day, that it took a minute for the demons he'd unleashed from inside to escape and then assault. The leather jacket was thick and soft, the construction solid. The smell seemed to rise and circle before constricting around his neck and chest. When he turned the jacket over, he noticed the subtle Harley-Davidson logo embossed in black on the left sleeve. An envelope slid out that Dave managed to catch before it hit the floor. The flap was tucked inside. Megan hated the taste of glue. He pulled out the card and stared. A funny card. She always bought a funny card. There was a dog in the front and words that read, "How old are you again?" Another day, another time, perhaps, he'd have read the punchline and laughed. Not today. The only place his eyes focused was on Megan's handwritten message. "Hey, ponytail man. Don't be sad, honey, about turning 40. You have your whole life ahead of you. I'm just grateful you chose me to share it with you. Enjoy the jacket, but don't get any ideas. Have a wonderful birthday. You were the love of my life. A life that would be incomplete without you. Forever. Meg. P.S. Remember, no matter what, I'll always be younger." It should have been a special gift. It could have been. Why did he think the pain wouldn't return, cutting his heart like a razor? He dropped to the floor, the jacket clutched in his fingers. Heaving sobs rushed in to replace the space abandoned by the day's happiness. On hands and knees, Dave crawled to the cherrywood cabinet and grappled for the closest bottle. It didn't matter what. Then, whiskey in hand, he cowered along the wall to the waiting darkness of the hall, where he began to drink. Drink and forget. Chapter 16. "He's not here yet?" Ellen questioned. Gloria shook her head. Sean Safford from Bike House had been waiting in the conference room for almost 10 minutes. Not a good way to impress a client.
"I just called his cell. He's running late. He said to get started."
"Late? Are you kidding?" Disappointment spread across Ellen's face like an afternoon shadow. She turned to Gloria.
"We're going to start without him. If he arrives within 10 minutes, send him in. Otherwise, tell him I have the account covered."
"Yes, ma'am. I understand."
Dave walked through the door 22 minutes later. Gloria glanced up in horror at his appearance. In place of his Armani suit and slacks, he wore jeans, a t-shirt, and a black leather jacket. Stubble showed on his face. His hair was tousled.
"Mr. Riley, are you all right? You look like..."
She stopped herself before the word slipped out. Despite being late, Dave didn't rush. He seemed to be in no hurry to get to the meeting.
"Honestly, I've had better weekends," he replied.
"Is there anything that I can do?"
She pitied his condition, hated to see him this way. It was tragic. No, heartbreaking, to watch someone with such potential waste away. He shook his head.
"Thanks, I'm fine."
The meeting has started. Miss Brewer asked me to tell you she has it covered.
Thanks, but...